This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and today's host for Trumpet Hour. Today, we'll start the show by talking about the Libyan crisis. There are hundreds of thousands of migrants pouring through Libya heading to Europe. And to do that, they have to cross the Mediterranean. They put their lives at risk. Why are so many people willing to risk dying to make it into Europe? And what is Europe going to do about this? This week, we saw one of those solutions. European leaders are promoting a new government in Libya, and they say they will even arm that government. We'll talk with Trumpet staff writer Brent Noctegal, and we'll find out whether this new idea will make things better or worse. Also, we'll talk about a revolution that might be brewing in China. Not since the days of Mao Zedong has China had such a strong leader. However, Xi Jinping is facing big troubles in China. The economy appears to be slowing down rapidly. There's social pressures growing. And we'll talk to Trumpet staff writer Andrew Miller about why Xi Jinping appears to be embracing the strongman concept. Also, we'll talk about Puerto Rico. This is a U.S. territory in the Caribbean, an island nation of 2.5 million people, and they can no longer pay their debt. They are facing collapse. Presidential candidate Donald Trump says he's not worried about debt issues for America. He says that if America were to default on its debt, that would be an okay thing, because one thing he has learned is that when you are going bankrupt, that's the time to negotiate your debt to get a good deal. He just cut a good deal for America. He put those deal-making skills to work. But what about in Puerto Rico? Will that work for Puerto Rico? Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders says socialism's the answer. So we'll talk about that. All this and more on today's Trumpet Hour. I have Trumpet staff writer Brent Noctegal. Brent is talking to us today from the city of Jerusalem in Israel. Brent, thank you very much for joining us today.
No worries. Good to be here.
How are things going over there? How's Jerusalem today?
Hot, really warm. There's a pretty heat wave heading through the Middle East right now. So we stayed indoors and cranked up the AC.
Well, that's good. You're making me a little jealous. It's cloudy and rainy here in Edmond, but I guess we know we'll have sun soon enough here in Oklahoma. So Brent, I'm glad to have you here today with us, because there really is a lot going on in the Middle East. And I know you have really a front seat view of what's going on over there in Jerusalem. You're getting a lot of the news that we aren't over here in the same way. You're getting a lot of on the ground information from local sources. So we really do appreciate that. Today, there is a nation that is making headlines around the world, and that nation is Libya. And that nation really has become a bit of a focal point recently, especially with the West's war against terror and against the Islamic State. And really, Libya, when we're talking about Libya, ever since NATO bombed Libya back in 2011 following the Arab Spring, Libya has been just a mess. It really has descended into chaos. And it really is terrible what's going on over there. I mean, I really feel for the people. Brent, maybe just before we begin talking about Libya, there really is a humanitarian crisis that's going on over there. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what it's like for people on the ground in Libya.
Well, it really depends, I guess, where you live in Libya, since the country has been so fractured since Muammar Gaddafi was removed. Basically, what happened after he left is the revolutionary forces that came together to remove him vied for power individually after that point, and it ended up creating a lot of infighting between these groups, and they fought as ferociously against each other as they did to remove the strongman from power as well. So depending on where you are, you would be under either the eastern the government in the eastern Libya, in eastern Libya, or the government in western Libya, or if you're in the middle, in different portions of southern Libya, but then also on the coast, there's a city of Sirte with about 1 million people, and they're under the rule of the Islamic State right now. And there's, you know, it's 1 million people there in that city. It's quite large, so they're experiencing as tumultuous events in their personal lives that we hear about and see about see on the news in Syria and in Iraq. It's a continuation of the same type of daily struggle under that tyrannical Islamist rule.
Yeah, it really is a humanitarian crisis in many ways. And I think, you know, I want to get to this other topic that I brought you here to talk about, talking about this new government that the West is trying to install. But before we get to that, Brent, we really can't divorce what's going on in Libya today from the refugee crisis, can we? I mean, that is, the refugee crisis going on in Libya and all the migrants heading to Europe, it really is connected to this, isn't it?
For sure. There, as we've discussed even on this program quite a lot, there's a couple of different routes that refugees are traveling from third world countries into Europe. And because of the Syrian civil war, the main bulk of the people that we heard about last year that were traveled into Europe came from Syria through Turkey, then into Greece, and then up through the Balkans and into Austria, Germany, and so on and so forth. But before that, there was already quite a large migrant crisis hitting the southern coast of Italy, where migrants were traveling from Tunisia and Libya, making or taking advantage of the lack of unified security forces in Libya to travel that short distance across to Malta or other islands that are within the EU or within Italy's sphere in its economic exclusive zone. And, you know, while we have seen the Syrian route through Turkey gradually close ever since the deal was kind of worked out between Turkey and Angela Merkel and the rest of the EU to try and seal up that border, people have started to travel, even Syrians have started to travel from Syria through North Africa and eventually get to Libya and then go across into Italy, or even just international waters. Just outside Libyan waters, there is currently right now a EU mission that is trying to capture people smugglers, their boats, and destroy them. They take the people off them before they do it. Obviously, I think they've in the past 6 months, I think they've got like 83 boats or something like that impounded or destroyed 83 boats. And this year, the Europeans are expecting 270,000 migrants to cross from Libya into Italy through this direction, as the other direction holds up. But it's not just Syrians that are coming across. I mean, it's a lot of African nations, Somalis, people from Uganda, people from Sudan. They're coming across, pretending some of them to be Syrians so that they will be accepted into Europe once they make it into the refugee camps in Sicily and such. So it's just the natural movement of human beings that has always taken place in history, from a really poor place that suffers from a lack of civil liberties, freedoms, to a more wealthy place where they will receive benefits and freedom. So there's partly that, and there's partly people running from war as well. And they are lining up on the beaches in Libya, ready to take these boats across into Europe.
Yeah, it really is hard to blame these people too much. I mean, it's when you look at the conditions that a lot of them are living in, I think it would be pretty easy to sympathize with them. I think Angela Merkel has taken a lot of flack, as you brought out on earlier programs. Over 1 million migrants have already made their way into Europe and mostly towards Germany and the core of Europe. But this was, and as you mentioned, this is something that has gone on for years, even predating the war in Libya. But this is something that has certainly intensified since the West took out.
For sure. It's been, I think, 2014. There was 170,000 migrants. I'm not sure of the stats before then, but it was definitely dramatically less than that, people entering Europe from Libya. And it looks like, again, I forget, up to March, I think there was close to 60 or 70,000 people that had already tried going over that from that border. We are seeing it increase even now.
So this really is something that Europe helped create, that NATO helped create. I mean, Muammar Gaddafi, obviously not really a nice individual, if you can put it that way. He was a dictator, a brutal dictator at times. I mean, when he overthrew the king of Libya, there was a lot of violence that occurred back in the late 60s when that was going on. But I mean, he was I'm a strong man for the past 40 years until.
And yeah, and he was even a, if I may, he was a strong man that was at least in part willing to go along with coming to be willing to go along with the West. I mean, he got rid of his new, he was like the one successful time or example of the West pressuring a nation to get rid of their nuclear program and them actually doing it. He did. He got rid of his nuclear material, finished his nuclear program. That was shortly after President Bush landed in Iraq. So Libya, he was probably expecting that could happen to him as well. But he wasn't at the time that he was overrun by NATO and the militias on the ground. He wasn't necessarily worse than he had been. In fact, it looked like he was coming close to the West.
Right. In fact, if you take a look at a lot of the metrics that were going on in there. Access to education, access to healthcare. In some ways, he really was an example of an African nation that actually was doing a fair bit for his people. You know, education was mandatory for both boys and girls, which is different than a lot of Muslim countries where it's the boys that get educated and the girls don't. There were, you know, they had free access to healthcare and some of those things. So I think there was something to be said about he was working with the West. He actually. Although he was painted as a very horrible despot, and there was, you know, certain validity to that, I think when the West ended up taking him out, the bulk of the evidence shows that things have gotten a lot worse for the people on the ground in Libya.
Certainly looking forward to our time and the past few years, that is definitely the case. As you said, I don't want to paint him out as a saint by any means. I'm sure there were a number of Libyans that lived underneath Gaddafi that were definitely happy that he was gone. But looking at what has replaced him, there hasn't been, you know, dramatic improvement, especially in the lives of some people.
Right. So 2011 rolls around. We go in, NATO bombs Libya. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says we came. We bombed. He died. President Obama since then has said one of his greatest regrets is not having a day after plan for Libya. So, you know, here's President Obama admitting that they, you know, we went in there, the West went in there, and we weren't even thinking about what was going to happen after. It was kind of this knee-jerk reaction. Since then, he's blamed Europe. He said, you know, President Obama said, well, the Europeans basically convinced me to go in there, and I thought that they'd have more of an day after plan, but that hasn't happened. So now we have this nation that is basically has been locked in civil war. Thousands of people are dying. There's a humanitarian crisis on the ground. We have waves, just tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of migrants pouring through Libya into Europe. And now Europe is saying, maybe this was a mistake. Maybe what we did in Libya wasn't so good, or at least a lot of people on the ground, a lot of people living in Europe, I'm sure, feel this way. So now the West is trying once again to do something about this. And you've written an article on thetrumpet.com about this, Brett, and I'm hoping that you can tell us a little bit about it. That article that will be going up on thetrumpet.com is titled Gambling with Libya's Future. So if you're interested in that, you can go to thetrumpet.com and learn more about that. But Brent, tell us what the West is trying to do now in Libya.
Right. So especially the Europeans, are going to solve the migrant crisis from Libya, and people coming into their nation, jihadis potentially being amongst those migrants, they're going to have to try and restore some element of order in Libya. So what we've seen over the past year and a half, especially the past year, is the United Nations Security Council, strongly headed by led by Europe in this way, try and work with the two governments that exist, that have existed inside Libya, and try and amalgamate them into one to produce a government that they can work with so that they can ensure that maybe levels of corruption aren't as bad as they are right now, to ensure that if this government is willing to include everybody, that they could give them arms, give them material support to try and remove the Islamic State in certain regions of the area as well. So we've seen them kind of create this government. It's called the Government of National Accord, GNA for short. And the GNA was agreed upon by the Security Council in December, and then, or who was going to head this interim government. And it was made up of some of the people from the East and some of the people from the West, different governments inside Libya. And the leader of that, the prime minister right now, he has moved in with his government to Tripoli. He came in March. And a lot of the people in the western side of the nation have submitted to the rule of the GNA. They want to come underneath that government that is supported by the West. Yet the House of Representatives that was democratically elected in Libya by the people, which is based in the east now, in Tobruk, they were left really kind of shafted in this new government. So you have that that elected government in the east that doesn't want to belong to this construct of the European Union, basically, is how they see it. They would rather, you know, all of Libya come together in some fashion. Now, good luck with that. I mean, that I can see why the EU and the UN have done this, because they need to try and find somebody that they can work with to produce peace in Libya. And they simply found this government and this leader that they believe that will do what they want, essentially.
For those of you just joining us in this conversation, we've been talking with Trumpet staff writer Brent Nachtigall, based out of Jerusalem, Israel. We've been talking about Libya. We've been talking about conditions on the ground in Libya, the humanitarian crisis, and the latest move by Europe to try to solve the problem. Basically, this week, European leaders came out and said that they are going to try to install and back a new government in Libya. And we've been talking to Brent about that. And Brent, maybe you can just tell us, in your opinion, what are the odds of probability that this will be successful?
Right. So this government, as yet, it I would say it probably has about half to a little bit less than half of the support of the Libyan people. But, you know, that's not to say that it might not be able to do some deals to garner more support from the rest of the Libyans in the future. But the way in which they have gone about this deal, at least the European Union, to produce a government there, it does have some people worried that the Europeans just interfering too much into the internal politics of Libya. Now, the most recent move that they have done towards this is just yesterday, when there was a meeting in Geneva between about 20 nations or 21 nations, including the United States, including the UN Security Council, a lot of nations in Europe, and some Middle Eastern nations as well. And they agreed that they would, in the next coming days, it seems, arm the government that they are, the UN-backed government. They are going to arm their soldiers, provide them with the implements, military implements that they're going to need to fight the Islamic State. And they also agreed to do a lot of training, with probably some boots on the ground there in different types of training missions, in at least starting around Tripoli in the western part of Libya.
So this seems like this could be a risky move.
Yeah, it's a risky move for a number of reasons. You know, a lot of the people, especially the eastern side, they see this government as being forced upon them by the Europeans, as I said, and they might be willing to actually take up arms and fight against the
foreign oppressor,
GNA supported militia. And really, if you're talking about which militia has been as the most successful in fighting the Islamic State, it is the Libyan National Army, which is a name given to the militia supporting the eastern government of Libya. They're the only ones that have had successes in battle against the Islamic State. They're led by a really well-oiled general from the past. I forget the amount of troops that he has, but he's had a couple of victories in Benghazi and Derna as well, some other cities that the Islamic State had a hold on, and he's been able to push them out. And yet the other militia that is aligned with the GNA, the UN-backed government, they haven't had any successes whatsoever against the Islamic State. In fact, on May 2nd, there was a small battle outside outside Sirte, and they actually cut and run. Now, it is a gamble for Europe to give materiel and arms to a militia that, while they won't turn on the EU, while they're not that powerful. What happens when you arm somebody and they go up against the Islamic State and they cut and run and they leave their United States or possibly even a European materiel behind? Then you have what we saw in Iraq, where the United States supported the Iraqi government against in the fight against ISIS. It came up to a couple of key battles. The Iraqi government fled, leaving behind all their thousands of American Humvees and other implements, and they went straight to the Islamic State. Now, that's what people are worried about right now in Libya, that this militia that they're arming will not be strong enough to fight against the Islamic State. They believe, especially the government in the East, that the only way that you are going to defeat the Islamic State in Libya is that if we all combine our forces. Yet, the European Union has and the UN has decided that they will not support the stronger, more battle-tested, proven government in the East and the army from the East. So we'll see. I mean, it seems like they're just repeating the mistakes of Iraq. Remove a strong man. Realize after you've removed the strong man, you don't have anyone to work with. You have competing interests with the different militias that were there that were aligned with you and did fight together to remove whoever. We see it happening again with the Islamic State. You've got all these groups fighting against the Islamic State. What happens if you remove the Islamic State? Who are you going to work with? They're all going to fight against each other. And that's kind of the situation which looks like happened after Muammar Gaddafi left. Everyone decided to fight against each other. And now we've got another fight against the Islamic State. What happens when you remove the Islamic State? What happens if they are successful? Then you're going to have this fractured state once again where they will fight against each other. Now, the European Union, I think they are aware of this potentiality. But I feel like, and even, you know, in the latest Trumpet, we have an article by the editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, about the Battle of the Mediterranean that's coming and how Europe sees the growing spread of radical Islam, you know, out from Iran, coming across the Persian Gulf, trying to influence Egypt, and now even into Libya, we see the spread of radical Islam. And Europe might realize, and even Mr. Flory's article says that there are visionaries in Europe that realize that they are going to have to confront radical Islam. So you can see that how this might lead to that.
Yeah, Brent, I'm really glad that you brought up that point, because I think that is just so important for everybody to understand. Like, prophetically speaking, there are reasons why we are watching Libya. We aren't just pulling Libya out of our hat and saying, look, there's these terrible things going on there. There are those terrible things in Libya, but prophetically speaking, this is an important country. This is a country that is specifically named in one of the most important end time prophecies in the book of Daniel. Maybe Brent, why don't you just tell us a little bit about prophetically speaking, what do we expect for to happen in Libya, and why are we watching it so closely?
Yeah, it seems like with all the problems in the Middle East, to zoom in on how the UN's backing a government, I mean, naturally you'd think this is great. They're trying to restore some peace and order to Libya, but we do see it in Bible prophecy, Libya being one of those locations through the Middle East and North Africa where we expect to see a face-off between a European power and a ultra-Islamic extremist power headed by Iran. Now, the specific prophecy that mentions Libya, like you said, is in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 43. And I'll just read that this scripture. It says, but he, in the scripture, meaning this European combined power headed by Germany, or as Daniel puts it, the king of the north, he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Now, that's what the King James says. But what does that mean? Well, at his steps means that eventually Libya and the Ethiopians are going to be put under the authority of this king of the north. There is going to be a military incursion into North Africa whereby the king of the north, or this European power, faces off against the Islamic power in that region, and Libya is specifically stated as one of those countries that is going to be gobbled up eventually by the EU. But again, why are they doing it? Why is the European Union getting involved? It's because they see what Islamic extremism is doing. They see, you know, they might not have like an image or a face to it, but they see the spread of radicalism take over North Africa, and they realize it's on their doorstep right now, and they have to act. And the article in the next Trumpet, I think it's really interesting, because it goes back to World War II, And it talks about how Europe, underneath with the alliance of the Italians and the Germans, they moved into Libya shortly after, well, at least in I think 1941 or 42, yeah, 1941 February, they moved into North Africa, starting in Libya, starting again right where these training missions are going to be held in the western part of Libya, and they marched across North Africa to try and control the Suez Canal and this whole region of the southern Mediterranean. They had a vision to take over the world, and if that was to be successful, they knew they must control the Mediterranean Sea. What do we see now from this prophecy in Daniel and from what we see on the ground? Iran trying to fulfill that same strategy. They want to control it. They want to control the Mediterranean, the Suez Canal, the Persian Gulf. That's why they're taking over, trying to take over Yemen, trying to influence what happens in Egypt, trying to influence what happens in Oman, and trying to influence what happens in Libya. And Europe says, no, you don't. And they're preparing for a greater battle in the future. And what we're seeing in Libya is the very beginning of them moving down.
Hey, Brent, very interesting things. Before I let you go here, just really... brings to mind the earlier part of that prophecy in Daniel 11, talking about Europe being motivated by a push. And I think Libya really does illustrate an aspect of that push, being the immigration crisis that really is pushing at Europe, and how that is being fueled by radical Islam really destabilizing that whole region in the Middle East there. Brent, thank you so very much for coming in today. This has been a fantastic interview, one of your best ones yet. So I appreciate that. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to Trumpet Hour on KPCG.fm or 101.3 on the FM dial. We've been talking to Brent Noctegal, staff writer for the Trumpet magazine based out of Jerusalem, Israel. Thank you very much, Brent.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Welcome back. We've been talking to Trumpet staff writer Brent Noctegal in Jerusalem. We've been discussing just the terrible situation in Libya today and with the refugee crisis there, and just how much of that really was caused by Europe and NATO. And Brent was just telling us how Libya is falling back into the radicals. The radicals really have a lot of influence again in Europe today. And now Europe is finally starting to act. They appear to be backing a new government in Libya. But even as they are now planning on arming and sending European and perhaps NATO-type arms into Libya, much of the country still doesn't recognize that government. A lot of Libyans don't want the Europeans there. Certainly Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State don't want them there, but really a whole lot of the rest of the country doesn't want Europe and the West there either, and it really is just a mess. Anyway, as Brent mentioned, prophecy backed by history and current events that are happening today on the ground, based on those things, we can expect to see a whole lot more of European involvement in Libya and North Africa in the future. So remember, you heard it here first. Watch for that in the future. Well, you're listening to Trumpet Hour on KPCG.fm online or 101.3 on the FM dial. I'm today's host, Robert Morley, filling in for Joel Hilliker. Mr. Hilliker is busily working on the latest edition of the Trumpet magazine. Speaking of which, if you haven't already, I encourage you to subscribe to the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. This is a current events news magazine. It covers everything from economy to science and geopolitics to family matters, society type issues. And probably, or one of the best parts about it, besides just the quality of the magazine, is that it's absolutely free. You really can't find anything like this anywhere else. So if you want to understand what's happening in today's world, if you want to be able to understand world events in their biblical context, in a prophetical context, if you want to understand what's important and what isn't, this is the magazine for you. There's, I think, somewhere around 300,000 other subscribers to this print edition. We have many other subscribers online. So go ahead and log on to the trumpet.com website. There's a subscription tab up there. It's very easy and simple process if you're interested. So coming up next here, we'll be talking about events in China, home of a billion people. almost 1/6 of the world's population. And here I have with me in the studio on Herbert W. Armstrong College campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma, I have trumpet staff writer Andrew Miller. So Andrew, hey, thank you very much for coming in today.
Yeah, no problem. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
I appreciate that because I know you do have a busy schedule. It's trumpet week here in Edmond. We're working on the latest edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet Print Magazine. I think this is the July edition. And I understand you actually have some article, at least a article coming up in this print edition.
Yeah, well, we've got the article coming up. Hopefully we'll have it online sometime here in the next week or two. I have a pretty good 4 pages on Bernie Sanders and the rise of socialism in America.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to that. But the reason I have you in the studio today and asked you to come in, and I do appreciate that, is that I would like to get your take on what's going on in China. In particular, I think it's very topical because last Monday was the 50th anniversary of Chairman Mao's Cultural Revolution. And I'd really like for you to talk a little bit about this. And I think it's important because this time period in China's history really was a terrible time for many, many people. It really was tragic. And there are some pretty disturbing signs that China might be headed back in that direction again. So just to begin, maybe Andrew, if you wouldn't mind, just bring us up to speed a little bit on what happened during the Cultural Revolution. I mean, this was a very violent time period in China's history.
Right. And you definitely have to understand the Cultural Revolution to get the context to look at Chinese policies today. And it was one of just probably maybe even the most horrible episode of the last century in China's history. I used to work for a man who was a vice president of a research and development firm down in Houston who had lived through the Cultural Revolution, didn't like to talk about it much, but he definitely can just confirm how horrible it was, especially to anyone like his family who did have a little bit of wealth at the time. But just looking through to kind of give an overview, you know, that Chairman Mao, Mao Zedong, was the leader of the Communist Revolution in China, which took power officially in 1949. And for the first few years, he ruled China as a communist dictatorship. But around the mid-50s, when Joseph Stalin died, and then, you know, Khrushchev took over, and he denounced some of Stalin's policies.
In Russia.
Mao Zedong was close with Stalin and viewed himself as a man similar to Stalin. And then he looked up in Russia and saw that, well, as soon as he died, they were trying to undo some of more of Stalin's authoritarian reforms. And he just became just obsessed and paranoid that as soon as he died, his revolution would be undone. So for several years, he really cracked down on the education system in China and raised a whole new generation of like high school age students indoctrinated in his version of like Maoist communism, and then did a very strange thing starting in 1966. He actually used the people against the Communist Party. Usually it's the other way around with communist regimes. They use the Communist Party against the people. But he came to the opinion that the Communist Party had been infiltrated by capitalist sympathizers and then just empowered these like high school, young college age students to just start hacking and killing people. And that even got out of hand, and he eventually had to use the military to kind of calm them down. And by the time it was all done, he'd just gone through a witch hunt for anyone with any wealth, anyone he thought had any capitalist sympathies, and had murdered, most historians say about 1.5 million people, although some estimates go as high as 8 million. Lasted about 10 years, 1966 to 1976, when he finally died.
Right. So this basically is the backdrop to conditions in China today. This is Chinese history that I think really is relevant. This is something that we should be concerned about today because of events that are going on in China. Today, China has a new leader, but this leader is doing some very disturbing things. He's making some disturbing moves.
Right. And because then you look at the backdrop of the Cultural Revolution, it almost kind of backfired after all these people were killed and had the opposite of what Chairman Mao intended. It was so horrible that the next paramount leader of China, Deng Xiaoping, instituted a lot of the more free market reforms that Mao was so paranoid about. And I mean, he didn't make China a free market economy by any means. He more transferred it from a totalitarian Marxist dictatorship to maybe an authoritarian socialist bureaucracy where people were allowed to own property as long as they did what the Communist Party told them to do with it. And they also moved into, instead of having this one cult of personality like Chairman Mao, you moved more into a committee, the Standing Central Committee of China, where there was a president, but there were eight other people, about a nine-person committee that ran the country, okay. More like a technocracy.
Okay, so that's where we are now. Since the revolution, everybody knows China has liberalized, right? President Clinton gave China his most favorite trading nation status, right? We're working to open China up. At least that's been the West policy, the United States' policy. And really, China has just experienced this economic miracle over the last 10 years, right? China has gone from this nation that barely registered in terms of global GDP and global economic clout to today it's the second or third largest, depending on how you measure it, maybe even the first largest economy on the world when you look at purchasing power parity, things like that. It's right up on the same level as the United States. And I think a lot of people looking at China today, they do see it, like you said, as a nation that's really been liberalizing, and it's starting to slowly but surely embrace Western-style democracy, Western-style freedoms. You know, they're trying to really sweep under the rug a lot of their history. You know, events like Tiananmen Square, things like that, that's played down, that's hidden from even the Chinese people, suppressed. But today we have a leader now in China, and this leader is, some people say that he's starting to move back in the other direction.
Right, yeah, the current leader of China, Xi Jinping, who came to power in 2013, they are really getting a lot of editorials on that he looks like he could be moving China, at least in the beginning stages, of back towards a one-man rule type government. I mean, that was one of his first decisions as president, is that nine-person council, he cut it down to seven people, and then they allowed him to choose during their leadership transition who your seven people would be. And usually, like the last president, he kind of had to choose some people who were friends of his and some people who were rivals with his, and if he ever tried to change anything too much, they had like a little bit of internal jostling, which kind of stopped him from making any huge reforms. But Xi Jinping, he's got this cut down to seven people, and they're all very loyal to him. So it's given him a lot more leeway than really any leader since Mao Zedong to control the government.
Some people compare him to President Putin in Russia. Think that's a valid comparison, or is that stretching it a bit?
It is actually. That's probably, if you could pick any leader on the world scene that he'd be similar to, that would be the one that's the most similar to. They both did a very similar thing recently. We actually had an article on our Trumpet website a few weeks ago about how Putin had picked his a former like judo sparring partner and bodyguard of his, and then empowered him with a 400,000 man strong police force that doesn't report to any cabinet minister of the Russian government. It reports directly to Putin, and it said that's really kind of showing that Russia has some hard economic times too, that he wants his own personal army and things in case things get kind of tough, where he and any of his cabinet ministers might turn against him. Xi Jinping did very similar with the he just recently declared himself commander in chief of the People's Liberation Army. And then there's also the their National Security Commission. He did this a couple years ago. He put that under his personal direction. So any espionage and any military functions go through him directly and not through that nine- or seven-person council.
Yeah, this seems like it is significant. We're seeing in several countries around the world, we really seem to be this trend of strongmen taking power. We're seeing the rise of strongmen. I think I saw an article in the Financial Times this morning, and the main premise of it was that if you look around the world, whether it's Russia or China or recently in the Philippines, their new leader that was just elected, we're seeing a lot of people turning and embracing strongmen. We're seeing the rise of the strongmen. And I think they were making the point that even Donald Trump might fall in that sort of category. But I think this is a trend that is important to watch just because of prophetically what we know is going to happen in China. I think it's also interesting how in tough economic times, people tend to look for a strongman.
Right. And George Friedman had a piece on for Maudlin Economics that had really brought out that point very well. In that he said under Chairman Mao in China, I mean, he used Marxist ideology as his means to control the people. And if they didn't like that, I mean, he had his Red Guard and he had his military that he could use to enforce that. After Deng Xiaoping did his liberalization efforts in China, it's still an authoritarian state, definitely. And Tiananmen Square occurred like 1989, well into the quote-unquote liberalized era. But they didn't have to be as authoritarian as Mao was just because the economy was good. It was really booming. Things were going well. People didn't have as much reason to protest against the government. Now, in both Russia and China, with the world economy in a slowdown, there's definitely a concern that you could get civil unrest. And the leaders of both nations are consolidate power in their office to use maybe an older, more authoritarian model. Putin's always spoke very highly of Joseph Stalin. Xi Jinping's a little carefuler talking how he talks on Chairman Mao, just because there are still people in China who remember him with mixed feelings. But as opposed to some of his predecessors as president of China who actually spoke against Mao, he's never actually spoken really negatively of. He always emphasizes that, hey, we had the first 30 years of Chinese history that was more the doctrinaire Marxist-Leninism under Mao, and then we had another 30-some years under the more liberalized opening. He said, but both are equally important to our culture, and we need to learn from, take the best parts of both those as we move into his now this new era of Chinese history that he seems to be heading up.
Right. And this new era, certainly from at least a Western perspective, seems like it is more like a return to a previous era in Chinese history. Just looking at what you see happening in China and Russia today, it sounds like what you're saying to me is that this return to the strongman, this return to more of an authoritarian, perhaps even rejection of some of the more Western liberal changes that have occurred in China. Are you seeing this as a reflection of deteriorating economic conditions in those nations? And if so, what's your take on China today? Is it worse off than maybe a lot of people think?
Yeah, well, especially, I don't know how many of the just average citizens in America really pay close attention to Chinese news, but I mean, you definitely can still say that the majority of our products we buy here are made in China. So, I mean, people definitely look at China as an economic superpower. And there was a poll recently, especially in Europe, there even, whether it's true or not, people are starting to view China as economically dominant over the United States. And there is definitely a lot of truth to that. But the era of just this fast growth seems to be slowing down. And so a lot of analysis are looking, both China and Russia, maybe a return to a more authoritarian political structure. I doubt highly that they'd go back to the exact political structure they had under Mao or Stalin. There's something people who study communist regimes call the 70-year itch, and it's more so like that under pure Marxism, you get about 70 years before your nation just collapses in an economic catastrophe. China's been unique that way, as they have been more flexible. They haven't necessarily adhered to all the tenets of Marxist-Leninism. They've allowed private ownership of property, but still government control, that they're actually making that it continues to function. Which could be pretty dangerous in a way, is that they're not as tied to the economic ideology, so they can be pragmatic about how they run their economy, but they're still keeping the authoritarian political side of that. So it'll be hard to say. Maybe they may make more changes to their economy to try to keep it going, but the political repressive side, it definitely looks like they're moving backward into the mid-20th century.
Yeah, I find that just fascinating to think about. What is China's future in terms of if it really is slowing down, if the economy is slowing down there? We've had all these news stories over the last decade just talking about how China has to produce all these millions of jobs each year to provide work for all these Chinese that are moving from the interior of the continent, coming out to the coast to try to find work. Now, if the economy is slowing down, it seems like this would leave a lot of very, very unhappy, dissatisfied, disillusioned Chinese. And I mean, what's going to happen for all these people if there's no work for them?
Because China is almost the opposite of Germany and the European Union in that way, in terms of their fiscal policy. You know, central bankers, they usually have to balance inflation with unemployment. If you get high unemployment, then the but like you say, if you print money, that produces inflation, but it also sometimes helps stimulate the economy, keep unemployment down. Now, Germany's mentally scarred from their Weimar Republic hyperinflation days in the 20s. So they're like, no money printing, no inflation. But because they refuse to print money to stimulate their economy, I mean, especially in the southern parts of the European Union, unemployment's getting up 20-30% amongst the youth. China will do the opposite. They may not like the inflation, but they'll take it to keep their unemployment as low as possible. Because even when you've got a billion people, if you had even 0.5% unemployment, is many angry people in the streets.
Right, and they'd rather borrow the money and print it into existence to get that short-term kind of boost, even though
keep the
long-term, that Germany appears to be more worried about, is risked when you're doing those sorts of things. I find that interesting. Andrew, maybe you can just tell us before as we start to wrap things up here, put it in context for us. Why are we watching China? Why are we watching these events so closely in China? Obviously this is something that we follow because of a Bible prophecy. Maybe you can just expound a little bit on that for us.
Right. And well, we mentioned the upcoming July issue of the Trumpet earlier, and actually China's our cover story for that issue. So I'll try not to give too much away until I encourage you to wait for that when it comes out.
Or subscribe.
If you haven't subscribed, definitely subscribe to that, because they've got a pretty powerful cover story, and it's more about I guess for the sneak peek, it's actually more about the South China Sea and China's attempts at militarizing the South China Sea and just really getting a lockdown on world trade
and those resources it needs for its economy.
Because right now, I mean, there are even some, I think was it Niall Ferguson, but there's even some historians who've termed the phrase Chimerica, just to shows that how much the Chinese economy and the American economy are intertwined right now. I mean, China produces stuff and America consumes it. That's why we have huge deficits, is they're doing all the producing and we're doing all the consuming. So they're getting all the money and we're getting all the debt. But it is also, I mean, if the American economy goes down, that hurts China, because who are they going to sell to? Or if the China economy goes down, that hurts America. So they are intertwined there. So it's very important to keep an eye on what the Chinese economy is doing, because it will play into economic crises here. It also, if you do have any economic crisis this year, it also would encourage China to diversify to other trade partners, Europe, Japan, places like that. And it is part of, you can see now with this more authoritarian structure under Xi Jinping, that they are really looking at militarizing the strategic sea lanes and the strategic trade routes around the world, that they make sure that they're able to export to keep their economy to flow. It might not even be exporting to America the whole time, but they still need control of those sea gates, even if they're going to export to other places. So we'll let you wait for the next Trumpet to find out more about if China's going to keep exporting goods to America or if they're going to switch trade partners here in the near future or not.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that preview, Andrew. It'll be interesting to watch this relationship. We know it is prophesied to break down between China and the United States. These days of the easygoing relationship will be coming to an end. We know the end game for that. So thank you for that, Andrew. Thank you also for coming in today. Appreciated you taking the time out during this Trumpet print edition week. You can look forward to an article on this topic, I'm hoping. I'll try to convince Andrew to write something up on this. And you can look for that on the trumpet.com website. So if you'd like more on this topic, you can look for that there. But it is time for a break. You've been listening to Trumpet Hour. This is KPCG.FM online or 101.3 on the FM dial here in Edmond, Oklahoma. Thank you for listening. We'll be back in a moment.
time for today's last word.
Well, now I'd like to talk to you about Bernie Sanders. Today, the Democratic presidential candidate took his anti-Wall Street, anti-capitalism message to Puerto Rico. While there, Bernie Sanders told an audience that, quote, if elected president of the United States, you will have an ally in the Oval Office. What did he mean by that? Just a little context. Earlier this month, Puerto Rico defaulted on millions of dollars in debt payments. The territory has borrowed up to $78 billion, and it can't pay it back. It does not have the money. And the problem for Puerto Rico is that it's not even allowed to default on its debt. By law, it cannot declare bankruptcy. So it's stuck with this debt that it can't pay, yet at the same time, it isn't allowed to go bankrupt. So the real world of Puerto Rico has no money is smashing head on into the fantasy world of, you know, by law, Puerto Rico has to pay back its debt. But reality is you can't get money from nothing. That is, unless you are Bernie Sanders and unless you are the Federal Reserve. We'll talk more about that in a moment. So Bernie Sanders is taking this message of socialism being the answer to Puerto Rico's problems to the voters in Puerto Rico. And I find this incredibly ironic because if you know anything about Puerto Rico, you know that this island is a socialist paradise. It has been socialism that has caused so much of Puerto Rico's spending and borrowing problems. Anyway, here's what Bernie Sanders said. He said, I'm not going to lower the standards of living of the people in Puerto Rico so that billionaires can have more profits. And he talked about how it's the billionaires that should lose the money. And the Puerto Ricans, he said, should not have to lower their standard of living. Later on in his speech, he talked about austerity. He said how the Puerto Ricans should not have to put up with austerity, meaning that they should not have to cut back on current standards to pay back the money that they borrowed. But here is what Bernie Sanders is not telling you. What Bernie Sanders is not telling you is, yes, a lot of millionaires and billionaires will make some money off of Puerto Rico's problems. However, there is a whole other class of individuals in the United States that are going to get hammered if Puerto Rico defaults on its debt, if Puerto Rico doesn't pay its debt, and that is pensioners. Pensioners, elderly, anybody who has a mutual fund in the United States, approximately 20% of mutual funds in the United States own Puerto Rico bonds. So that means there's a whole host of Americans, many poor Americans and elderly Americans on fixed incomes that'll be hurt if Puerto Rico does stop paying its debt, which is what presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is advocating. But don't worry, he also has another solution. He said that the Federal Reserve should use its powers to its emergency powers to restructure Puerto Rico's debt. He says essentially that the Federal Reserve should just print the money. Just push the button, print up some money. That'll solve Puerto Rico's problems. Forget the fact that printing money comes with its own host of problems, but we'll just forget about that. We'll just hit the button, print the money, and voila, it's kind of like magic. Puerto Rico's debts will go away. They'll be restructured, quote unquote, via the Federal Reserve. Wouldn't that be nice if we all had our own personal money printing machine that we could just push the button and take away all of our problems, all of our worries? Well, that is Bernie Sanders' solution to Puerto Rico. Will that work for America? We have $19 trillion, almost $20 trillion worth of debt. We promised another $60 to $100 trillion, depending on who you talk to, in promises via Medicare and Medicaid and all the entitlement programs we have in America. These are important questions. Bernie Sanders is not going away. He is already having an impact on America, and he's moving the economic questions far to the left. So more to look forward to when it comes to socialism in America. If you'd like more information on this, we have our July edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine just about ready to go to print. In this edition, it tackles a question about socialism and what the Bible says about socialism, because surprise, surprise, the Bible has a lot to say on socialism, on how we should manage our finances, how nations should manage their finances, God's laws on finances. So if you're at all interested in that, go ahead and log on to thetrumpet.com and click on the subscribe tab, and it'll take you to an option where you can subscribe for the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine. Okay, that's about all we have time for today. You are listening to Trumpet Radio. Thank you very much for joining us today for this Trumpet Hour program. A big thanks to all our guests. Thanks to Brent Noctegal and Andrew Miller. Thank you to Joel Hilliker for inviting me on the program today. And also a big thanks to our technical staff, always doing a fantastic job, Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau, and the indomitable Josh Sloan. And for all those others who are working behind the scenes as well, thank you very much. Tune in tomorrow, same time, same place, 101.3 on the FM dial and kpcg.fm online and at thetrumpet.com. And until next time, I'll leave you with this. Keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.